This is Harvard Magazine Managing Editor Jonathan Shaw talking with Elizabeth Goodrice, the author of The Unlikely Writer, a profile of Atul Gawande in the September-October issue of Harvard Magazine. Elizabeth, why don't you start out by telling me how this article began?
Atul Gawande was someone I had admired as a writer for a long time, had been reading his stuff in The New Yorker, and then when I came to work at Harvard Magazine 2 years ago, at some point after that, I realized he was a professor at Harvard Medical School and so might be a candidate for a profile. So at that point, I started trying to write up a pitch for my editor and started doing some more research. And I realized that in addition to writing for The New Yorker, he has all of these other things that he does, teaching and surgery. He's a very busy surgeon. And also all of these research projects in cooperation with the World Health Organization, trying to improve surgical safety in the developing world. And during the time that I spent with him, I kept expecting to find him cutting corners somewhere, but I never found anything. All of these things, none of them are just resume padding. These things are all actually meaningful to him and things that he puts a lot of energy and attention into. And that became a big theme in the story, Atul Gawande's balancing act.
He's a parent too, isn't he?
He is a parent. I should have mentioned that he is a father of three. He has a son and two daughters. And he is home pretty much every night for dinner, he tells me. Wow. And his wife did not disagree with that.
Now tell us, how did you go about reporting the article?
Well, I spent a total of 7 days, maybe not full days each time. There were some full days, but on and off, I would attend some speaking engagements, and I spent some time with him in all the different settings that he works in. So I got into the operating room. I was in the exam room as he did pre-op and post-op consultations with patients. I sat in on his research team meeting one day, and was on a call with him one day. So between all of those things, I got to see him in sort of all his different natural settings. And it was just really a really amazing experience, the kind of access to kind of behind closed doors in Brigham and Women's Hospital. And the other thing that I learned is that this man has just an amazing amount of stamina. So there was the morning of the day that I spent with him in the operating room, I had to meet him at, I think it was like, I know that I had to leave my house at 5:30 in the morning. I had to meet him at something like 6:30. And that was fine. I'm used to getting up pretty early, but just, you know, I was on my feet all morning as he was, and he was working harder than I was. Operating, you have to concentrate pretty hard, probably harder than as a reporter. And even so, by noon, by lunchtime, I was just feeling woozy and delirious. And I remember we sat down and he was eating a taco salad. I don't remember what I was eating. And we were talking just kind of informally. I remember just realizing that I wasn't entirely making sense and wondering how he could go back into the operating room and do 3 or 4 more operations yet that day. Which, by the way, I left before his day was over.
You remarked in the article as well that he's a very humble man.
That's right. As I mentioned in the article, I came to the conclusion that he is a genuinely humble person. And I really had my feelers out for that because that was the one question that people would ask me when I would tell them that I was working on this profile. They wondered, is he a nice guy? As accomplished as he is, how can he not be arrogant? How can he not be a jerk? But everyone that I interviewed for the article made a point of mentioning how humble he is. Some of the students who've worked with him, research assistants, clerical assistants, mentioned to me that he went out of his way to give them meaningful work and in some cases go outside of their job description and really give them opportunities to get into settings like the operating room, like patient exams and assisting him in procedures where appropriate, but really making sure that they had meaningful experiences that were educational and not just busy work. And then one more example of humility. So as I quoted him saying in the story, he still doesn't see himself as much of a writer. But in fact, if you look at his writing, it really stands up to the rest of what's in The New Yorker, in my opinion, and even is among the best of it. For example, there's one article of his that I love because of the reaction that I had to it, there's a chapter in his book, Better, which originally was a magazine article, but it's about a pregnant woman. And it starts with this detailed account of her going into labor, and it's blow by blow her story. And the way he builds up suspense, as I was reading it, I was trying to figure out why I was completely on the edge of my seat and feeling so tense that I actually had to jump ahead. He tells her story, and then he zooms out and gets the big picture. So he's talking about how dangerous childbirth is and how much safety in childbirth has improved in the United States, and what we can learn from that and from how it was achieved. So he gets into these sort of policy and healthcare systems issues, and then at the end of the, he returns to her story. So I actually had to skip ahead. I could not bring myself to read through the whole article from start to finish. I had to skip ahead and find out what happened to this woman. In fact, it turned out that she had a complication-free, safe birth. Maybe I shouldn't have given the ending away. But it was one, really impressive to me that he could build that level of suspense. It seemed like foreshadowing that something really terrible was going to happen, and nothing did. But also through that device, he made the point of how dangerous childbirth is and just how wrong it has the chance to go. And that, I thought, was really clever.
Now, you were able to go into the operating room with Dr. Gawande. What was that like?
First of all, it was much messier than I expected. I mean, of course, the human body is generally a messy thing. And when you have surgery, you expect there to be some blood. And I'm not a person who's easily grossed out, but just, you know, the size of the wound in someone's throat really surprised me. It makes sense that it would be an inch or 2 or 3 inches big, because you have to see in there to operate, but sort of imagining it in the abstract and actually seeing it were two different experiences.
One thing that I will not soon forget about the operating room is the smell.
As the surgeons go, the cutting tool that they use actually doesn't exactly cut. It burns to cut. And this is so that it cauterizes all of the small blood vessels as they go, so that the person doesn't bleed or bleeds less. And so consequently, the scent of burning flesh just hangs over the operating room. And now I had really mentally prepared myself to see some things that might be disgusting or disturbing, open wounds, blood, but the smell just added a whole other dimension. I did get used to it over the course of the day. First thing in the morning, I was pretty sure that I was not going to be able to tolerate it, and it turned out to be just fine. And I'm sure as a surgeon, you get very used to it and probably don't even notice it anymore. But let's just say that at the end of the day, I could not wait to get home and change clothes and wash that scent out of my hair. And then I also want to talk a little bit about the degree of access that we were able to get, because I think it was really extraordinary. So first of all, Dr. Gawande agreed to let us into the operating room, me and a photographer. And they were very, very patient. And also, all of the people, all of the patients who were getting surgery that day agreed to let us in. And I really appreciate that, because I don't know if I were having surgery, if I would consent to that. And so the day started out with us all, with me and the photographer, kind of hanging around the edges in the corners. And I have to say, I was nervous looking around. There are cords all over the place. There's, you know, this tray full of instruments that you could elbow and rattle and tip things over. And so I was really hanging back at first, especially while the photographer was there, just letting him do his thing. And I was standing in a corner and watching. Toward the end of the day, it was really remarkable. I gradually became less and less squeamish and more curious about wanting to see what was going on. So I stepped closer to the patient. And then at one point, Dr. Gawande suggested to me that if it was okay with the anesthesiologists who stand behind the patient's head, that maybe I could get up on a stool also over the patient's head and just look. So I ended up having this vantage point right above the patient and having a bird's eye view of what was happening, being able to actually see what Dr. Gawande and the resident were doing with their surgical instruments and seeing, you know, it helped me to understand the surgical procedures. And it would have been a pretty boring day standing off to the side and not being able to hear what they were saying and see what they were doing. I'll just tell one more story about the reporting of the article, which is that there was one day when I was spending the day with Dr. Gawande. He was on call and he had some meetings that I couldn't be in on. And so he let me use his office to work while he was tied up. And I had some of his articles, actually, that I hadn't read yet that I had brought along and some notes to go through and figure out what I was going to use from previous days with him. But of course, as soon as the door was closed, I looked through all of the titles of the books on his bookshelves and the photos of his children on his desk and the art and the other things he had hanging on his walls. And the whole time I was in there, I was just thinking that I don't know if I would give someone that kind of access to my office. But that time turned out to be really valuable, just being alone with the set of objects this person had in his workspace and thinking about what they said about him. So I didn't have to be interviewing him and surreptitiously trying to glance around and look at the titles and not really be listening to him. In fact, this was where the ending for the story came from, the bit about the Sylvia Plath poem he had on his desk. While I was in his office, I had the time to read the poem and to write parts of it down and to think about it. And so I was really grateful for the degree of access he gave us and the amount of trust he was willing to place in us.